I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection. Our guest is Amy Tan, who after nearly 6 years has emerged with a new novel, The Bone Setter's Daughter, which begins in San Francisco, travels back in time to a village in China before World War II, and returns to California once again. Ruth Young is the central character in the first part of the book, a ghostwriter searching for passion and a place in her life. Her mother is Lu Ling, a worrisome, willful Chinese woman who is beginning to show the first signs of a slipping memory. But before the past can entirely be lost, Ruth happens upon her mother's memoir. In luminous prose, surrounded by mystical currents, the second part of the book then belongs entirely to Lu Ling, as well as her mute and disfigured nursemaid, Precious Auntie, who talks with her hands and speaks on a chalkboard. The last and third part of the novel belongs to the three women together, who are separated by time, but connected through the force of words. Listener, if you're an Amy Tan fan, here's your chance to make a connection. 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Makes the Amy Tan connection. And you can also join us online at theconnection.org. Amy, welcome to The Connection.
Good to be here.
I have to confess that even though I'm an avid consumer of fiction and a former teacher of American literature, I hadn't read an Amy Tan novel until The Bone Setter's Daughter, which I enjoyed thoroughly. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit about the cover of the novel. It's a gold cover, but on the back's a great picture of you.
Oh, thanks.
And on the front is a picture of, who is that?
That actually is my grandmother. It was taken around 1902, and she's probably about 18 years old. And there's something in that photo that's quite arresting to me and why I stared at it for so long. I mean, she has this look as though she can see into the future, and all of it is either at sometimes good and sometimes bad. You know, kind of like a Mona Lisa effect. You never know what she's really thinking. And I was trying to figure out what she was thinking at the time. You know, look at the eyebrows there, too. See how they blend in with the slope of the hills in the back, as though she is also fading into the background. Anyway, I assume the picture was taken in Shanghai, but I don't know what the circumstances were exactly. She has winter padded clothing on and this strange embroidered headdress. So part of it, for me, is to imagine all that led up to this moment of taking the picture. And she figures, this image figures very much in the book.
It would suggest, having put your grandmother on the cover of the novel, that this is a very autobiographical novel. And I know suggesting that to a novelist sometimes can be offensive because it suggests that you're simply creating a documentary record of the past
rather than an act
of imagination. But I don't mean to suggest that, but tell me a little bit about how autobiography figures into this.
I think of my work as being highly personal, meaning that the ideas, the emotions, the questions I have when I'm writing are based very much on what I'm feeling and what I am interested in. That there are correlations, for example, that my grandmother killed herself and my mother saw this happen, and I have written about characters who kill themselves and whose daughters are affected, and that affects next generations. But beyond that, the context of the stories, the details, you know, are not necessarily mine. I'm, you know, don't have a marriage like the one described or the relationship described in any of the books I've ever written about.
That's good.
Yes, because usually they have pretty lousy relationships, but, you know, happy ones don't make for good fiction. And the story about in this book about the ink maker's family and the bone setter and the excavation of Peking Man in 1929, that did not happen to my family, though, you know, there was a Precious Auntie in my family, and her face was marred. So, you know, there are these connections, but they are emotional ones.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can join us with Amy Tan. We're talking about her new novel, The Bone Setter's Daughter. The mother-daughter relationship, which has figured prominently in other fiction of yours, I'm told, since I haven't read it, I can't say that with authority, but I hear that that's the case, figures very strongly in this. And in an interesting way, because each daughter has to discover what she can of her mother's identity through a written document, through a memoir.
Yeah.
This happens the first time with Ruth's grandmother, and then a second time when Ruth's finding out about her mother. And mother-daughter relationships, I've discovered recently, because I've been watching one rather closely, can get really tangled and difficult. I don't know exactly why that is so difficult, but here you have the daughter trying to unravel a mother's past. Why is that such a prominent theme in this?
I think mother-daughter relationships tend to be very intense ones because it goes through so many changes in life. In this case, the mother, Lu Ling, and Ruth were separated by a chasm of misunderstanding, but also pain. You know, here was a mother who often threatened to kill herself, and a daughter who stood by, mute, unable to protect herself, and also had to serve as her mother's translator, you know, translating in stores and, you know, oftentimes, you know, translating for the mother. My daughter is so terrible. What should I do with her, you know, to the minister or whatever? And, you know, Ruth would have to translate. I'm having difficulties with my child. What recommendation, you know? So a daughter who resented in part her childhood, has learned to distance herself from her mother, and then finds that there are a number of things that haven't been said when she comes across this memoir. As you said, in a similar fashion, Lu Ling did not know until it was too late what precious auntie had written down for her. And she receives this confession, so to speak, when it's almost too late, and it haunts her.
Lu Ling's mother, the identity of her mother is concealed from her for a long time. She thinks it's her nursemaid, and it in fact is her mother. And she discovers this. I mean, one of the things you do here, it seems to me, is you reveal the explosive nature of a mother-daughter relationship. In both cases, there's a suicide and an attempted suicide. In one case, inadvertent, because Lu Ling, being distracted by marriage and the pleasures of Peking, ignores her nursemaid's memoir and
her wishes
and loses her mother. And in the case of Ruth and Lu Ling, Ruth writes in her diary at one point.
Yes, writes some very wounding words that lead to consequences she has a hard time thinking about years later. She kind of remembers as she's going through her mother's past. As I was doing this and I was looking at my own mother who was losing her memory, it reminded me that it was of archaeological expeditions, you know, that you're excavating layers and layers of the past and trying to reconstruct what that past was and how a person evolves from that, you know, how it affects each generation.
The excavation motif runs throughout here. We've got, at the same time, we've got these mystical bones that are used as, that are inscribed and used as
oracle sort of bones.
Oracle bones that are used as a way of predicting or divination, of divining the future by driving a spike into them and finding cracks. Then the diviner reads those cracks. And then we've got Peking Meng. This is a scientific excavation that's going on side by side with the folks digging up bones in caves for these folk purposes.
Those oracle bones were also linked to, in part, to the discovery of the site where Peking Man was found. They had, you know, they were like the old Ouija board. The oracle bones had messages from the gods written on them. And some of these bones, it turned out, may have been the teeth of early Peking Man.
You talk about the mother-daughter relationship. There's a reading on 53 that we should have you do from the book about the excavation.
Okay. This is a passage that has to do with writing, and I think
this is about calligraphy. Yes,
calligraphy. Right. This is about the idea that when you write, you know, it has something more to do with simply the mechanics of writing. Lu Ling is talking. When you write, she said, you must gather the free flowing of your heart. To demonstrate, Lu Ling wrote the character for heart. See, each stroke has its own rhythm, its balance, its proper place. Lu Ling started to write a simple horizontal line, but the movements were not simple. She rested the tip of the brush on the paper so that it was like a dancer's sur les pointes. The tip bent slightly downward, curtsied, and then, as if blown by capricious winds, swept to the right, paused, turned a half-step to the left, and rose. Ruth blew out a sigh. Why even try? Her mother would just get upset that she could not do it right. Some nights Lu Ling found ways to help Ruth remember the characters. Each radical comes from an old picture from a long time ago. She made a horizontal stroke and asked Ruth if she could see what the picture was. Ruth squinted and shook her head. Lu Ling made the identical stroke. Then again and again, asking each time if Ruth knew what it was. Finally, her mother let out a snort, the compressed form of her disappointment and disgust. This line is like a beam of light. Look, can you see it or not? To Ruth, the line looked like a spare rib picked clean of meat. Lu Ling went on. Each character is a thought, a feeling, meanings, history, all mixed into one. She drew more lines, dots and dashes, downstrokes and upstrokes, bends and hooks. Do you see this? She said, over and over. Tink, tink, tink. This line, and this, and this, the shape of a heavenly temple. And when Ruth shrugged in response, Lu Ling added, in the old style of temples, as if this word old would bump the Chinese gears of her daughter's mind into action. Ping, ping. Oh, I see. Later, Lu Ling had Ruth try her hand at the same character, the whole time stuffing Chinese logic into her resistant brain. Hold your wrist this way, firm, but still loose, like a young willow branch. Aya, not collapse like a beggar lying on the road. Draw the stroke with grace, like a bird landing on a branch, not an executioner chopping off a devil's head. The way you drew it, well, look, the whole thing is falling down. Do it like this. Light first, then temple, see? Together it means news from the gods. See how this knowledge always comes from above? See how Chinese words make sense?
It's a beautiful passage, and it has a lot to do with the theme of communication that runs throughout history. We've got ink makers.
And a mother trying to force ideas in her daughter's brain.
Right. And a daughter seeing this as a spare rib picked right. clean of meat. What a savage metaphor for miscommunication. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Amy Tan on The Connection. I'm John McChesney.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Brookline Booksmith, presenting River...
From WBUR Boston and National Public Radio, I'm John McChesney. My guest is Amy Tan. We're talking about her new novel, The Bone Setter's Daughter. 1-800-423-8255. You can join The Connection. Join our conversation, 1-800-423-TALK. Amy, one of the things that I was struck with in the novels, in the early section, you have Ruth organizing a family dinner on a Chinese holiday, and she's pulling together both the Anglo members of the family, members of the family that are a product of divorce, children who are Ruth's, not quite her stepchildren yet, but white folks are sitting sort of over here, and the Chinese folks are sitting over here, and Ruth is trying to pull all this together. Yeah. And then, as we go into the middle section of the book, we have this exploration of the earlier Chinese family and the insistence throughout the book that family history matters.
Mm-hmm.
And the opening of the memoirs, these
yeah.
things I must remember.
Yeah.
In the chaos of the modern family, it seems to me there's often a total disconnect from any family history. There's mm-hmm. divorce, there are separations, people spring up in the suburbs, seem to have no roots at all. Why do you think family history, mm-hmm. drilling back and excavating family history, is so important?
That family history reverberates in our lives in ways that we may not be aware of. You know, I discovered later in life that my grandmother had killed herself, and that this was the reason why my mother had this feeling she too was going to die when I was very young. You know, when I was about 6 years old, I remember her telling me, well, when I didn't want to listen to her, you know, and practice the piano, and she'd say, well, what does it matter anyway? Soon I'll be dead, you know. And it frightened me as a child, and I thought, why is she telling me this? Later, I resented her saying things like that. And it wasn't until later that I understood that when she was 9, she saw her mother kill herself, that she had this recurring image, and that this, too, affected me. I mean, I suffer from depression. I didn't know where it came from. Even in the happiest moments of my life, I'd find myself in this terrible despair of meaninglessness. And, you know, it came from my background, transmitted either through heredity or environment or, you know, emotional framework that wasn't passed on from generation to generation.
And that's the emotional history of your family. That's
yes.
sort of exploring
yeah.
the emotional causality that leads to how you're formed as a person. But you also, in this book, are playing a lot with cultural and international history. I mean, we're going back pre-liberation of China, pre-World War II, and working
right.
our way up through World War II
mm-hmm.
and the communist takeover.
Mm-hmm.
All of that's tied together. And In the rootless contemporary American family, there's very little of that drilling back and finding that family history. I often uh-huh. wonder if that isn't why genealogy is one of the most popular things on the internet.
Uh-huh.
People are trying to figure out
right.
some
right.
rootedness. But do you think it's more important for someone who's a second generation immigrant to America to sort of drill back and find that history?
I think that there is more interest now. And you know, part of this has been social. That when I was growing up, it was almost improper to think about what was called Red China back then. And, you know, I didn't want to know. It was almost shameful. We have more kids learning about cultures as part of the curriculum. And I think that people want to know and share in a history. You know, I had a feeling, for example, that my history didn't begin in this country until 1949, which is the year my mother came to this country. And American history was not that interesting to me because I couldn't imagine my ancestors being there at, you know, Turkey Day. And yet I do know now that history is I'm an American and that history is my history. But I have this other history where I can think about my ancestors watching certain landscapes at historic moments, that my grandparents were involved with revolutions and had to migrate during the Taiping Rebellion and were affected by missionaries and educated by them and things like that. And I have a personal link to that history that makes it much more interesting to be rooted that way, to be rooted in multiple ways.
And you have this marvelous skill to share it with the rest of us, which is really nice.
Thank you. Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection. Louise, you're on The Connection.
Hi there.
Welcome.
Hi.
I just want to thank you for the first book, for all of your books, but especially for the Joy Luck Club.
Oh, thank you.
When it came out, I had a young woman who was friends with my daughters, who is Chinese-American, and who was having a lot of problems with her parents, and she came to live with us and stayed with us all the way through college. And I never knew how to deal with her problems because I, as an American mother, I couldn't understand how the grandmother threatened to commit suicide when this granddaughter didn't act the way they wanted her to, and how they wanted her to be an American, but they wanted her to be Chinese. And then I read the Joy Luck Club, and it really explained all of it. it's interesting. She's tried to read it 3 times, and she can't get through it because she cries too much.
Oh. You know, it's amazing to me how that story, I wrote that story because I was like that girl. I just thought nobody had a life like mine.
Right.
Nobody would understand. I had to write a story for myself to make sense of the world and give meaning to things that had happened. And it was so amazing to me after that book came out and people said, that was my experience. You know, and I wanted to say, well, I didn't try to write a book about all Chinese Americans. And I certainly don't think that all Chinese mothers are that way. But it's amazing when you do write something and it strikes a common chord. And I will say it's also, it hasn't been just Chinese American women who've read this who've told me. It's been other people from other cultures whose parents maybe had traumatized lives in other countries,
mm-hmm.
and were not able to talk about some of the things that affect the way they raise their kids. With this, you know, raise their kids with a sense of danger and, you know, a sort of fatalism and warnings that don't necessarily jive with parenting skills
Well, I just want to thank you. It was just wonderful, and I'm looking forward to reading the new book.
Thank you for your call.
Bye-bye.
1-800-423-8255. Ruby, welcome to The Connection.
For taking my call. It's such an honor to be talking to Amy Tan. I have about 50 pages left of The Bone Setter's Daughter. I'm a little bit nervous, as you can tell. And I just think it is so beautiful. It's probably one of the most beautiful works of literature that I've read in the last 3 years.
Oh, thank you.
And I just want to thank you for writing it. It's just, I mean, you can tell my emotions probably over the phone. I have cried. I have laughed. It's just absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That's all I have to say, I guess.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Ruby, thank you. One of the things you do in the book is you return from the to the contemporary part of the novel at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth is finding that Lu Ling is losing her memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe this is something that you drew on personally
yes.
with your
yeah.
mother.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to her home and you find this chaos, neatly folded napkins in huge
mm-hmm.
piles,
mm-hmm.
Food decaying in the refrigerator,
right.
and you realize that the chaos of her life her life is just unraveling
right.
in terms of
that she can't take care of herself anymore. Yeah, I saw that in my own mother, and it takes a while to realize. Well, you know, my mother had a difficult personality. It was, we, you know, had a hard time distinguishing between a worsened version of her difficult nature and this increasing dementia. She would get into arguments and we weren't able to figure out, you know, what was going on until some of the delusions came out, or seeing the food that had been defrosted multiple times. And it's frightening, I think, to realize you have to take care of a parent and figure out how to do that, get rid of the demons for them. I do have to say it was not altogether the most terrible thing that could have happened to my mother. It certainly is a terrible disease, especially when somebody gets it younger. But my mother, and it varies from individual to Alzheimer's, my mother forgot a lot of the worries that she had. For the first time in her life, she said, I'm happy. I have no worries. She lived a full emotional life, sometimes uncensored. You know, she was a very vain woman, and she loved being told she was beautiful, that she was the most important person there. Yes, you know, and that's that all the presents belonged to her. You know, it was a wonderful life, and I think that kind of happiness was not a delusion. I think it was true happiness, and so, you know, I'm glad my mother found that at the end of her life.
In the novel, Lu Ling discovers mm-hmm. a man.
Yes.
A man.
She finds love. She has a boyfriend, and they go around holding hands and, you know, imagining that they went through certain periods of time together in the past. I mean, he's not imagining this, but he is the translator of her memoirs. He translated from Chinese into English, and by the time he finishes, he feels he knows this woman so well because he is worked with the words and the intentions of her words and her images that he is in love with her. And it doesn't matter that she is now losing her mind. He is anchored to her past and wants to continue forward with her. And Ruth sees this and wonders about this kind of love, but as...
She's had a tough time with love in her past.
Yeah, you know, and the guy she's living with sees this too and sees that, you know, being together is not simply about, you know, a certain kind of love with boundaries, that, you know, there are some people who would have this kind of love that goes in all directions.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Heather is on the line from Yorktown, Virginia, going south. Heather?
Hi.
Hi.
I am afraid I'm totally going to gush. I can't believe that I actually got online to probably one of my favorite authors. I grew up in California and spent a lot of time in San Francisco, especially in Chinatown. And as a child, I remember absolutely being fascinated with all the neat store shop fronts and seeing all the different kinds of things. And I just wanted to express my appreciation for taking a few of your stories and putting them into children's books.
Oh,
I think the one is, forgive me, I can't remember the names. One is the Chinese Siamese Cat.
Right, and the Moon Lady.
And the other one, the Moon Lady.
Right.
And
yeah,
it's very important to me since I don't live close to a place where I can get my kids exposed to a real ethnic neighborhood right now. And so through books like yours and through Chinese restaurants, I am able to show to my children that there are other cultures besides the Western European one.
Did you know that this Chinese Siamese Cat is going to be actually on a PBS animated series starting in September?
Oh, no.
It'll be
how
airing 2 days a week and 5 days, or two times a day, 5 days a week. And it's geared, I think, to 5 to 9-year-olds.
We will look forward to that. And I also wanted to say that even though a lot of the Chinese Americans looked at your books and said, well, this was my experience, a lot of us Western European-derived women were able to look at that. I mean, bottom line, when you look at things, there's not so much difference between cultures. I think all of our mothers are really good at dishing out the guilt, no matter what your background is. So I found a lot of validation there, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
California plays a significant role in your novels. And I wonder if you had actually ended up somewhere else in the United States, say New York, or, I mean, just as and grown up in New York or grown up in Boston or somewhere else, would that have changed the way you perceive the United States in significant ways? I mean, you talk about Chinese culture as the identity of people seem to be sort of locked in the old culture. Mm-hmm. And then you move to California, where everything is floating. And if you want to reinvent yourself in California, that's where you do it.
Yeah. I suppose some people think of that as being kind of the ultimate place you go for the American dream, as you said, reinventing yourself, even in Hollywood. It was also different because we ended up moving later to the suburbs, from town to town to town, as though we could move up in the world literally by moving to a better and better city or house or whatever. My mother was always fleeing from certain internal demons that she was unhappy and she'd find it in a place. So place is very important to me. I don't know whether, say, New York would have been more insular in the sense that it would have stayed more in the Chinese community and not have moved into the suburbs. Or if I had grown up in, you know, Missouri or Kansas City or someplace like that.
That's where I grew up.
Oh, great place. I've been there. Whether that would have made a difference also, because I've met people who say it was, you know, they were the only Chinese girl in the school, and, you know, that changes things as well. I've been lucky in that as a writer, I've been through multiple experiences, both being in a very tight-knit Chinese community and not knowing almost anybody who was not Chinese, and then being almost the only Chinese girl in my school, being living in Switzerland for a year quite by fluke. So many experiences that have helped me, have become useful to me as a writer.
1-800-423-8255. We're talking with Amy Tan about her new novel, The Bonesetter's Daughter. 800-423-TALK. Jim is on the line. Jim?
Hello, Miss Tan.
Hello.
I just have to compliment you. You have a wonderful series of books that introduced us to Chinese, American, and the Oriental groups of people that compromise the United States citizenry. I found a similar book introduction in the book Stella Got Her Groove, where she talked about meeting African-American family.
Oh, Terry McMillan's book. Yeah, that's...
It was a beautiful book.
Yes, yes.
And I think what you've done is shown us that as you're born, you have no memory, no animosity, no aggravation. And as you develop through your years, become an octogenarian and perhaps an Alzheimer-type person, you again have no animosity, aggravation, or memory, you're happy in your life. What my question was to you is I seldom have an opportunity to read fiction, but I do love listening to books on tape when I drive, and especially when the author reads the book. I think you had one book on tape that you did.
I have actually done all my books on tape, including the children's books.
I've read one of them, or listened to one of them, I should say. But I have to tell you that is an absolutely marvelous way to present your story to the American public.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
We have to take a break now. 1-800-423-8255 when we come back. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney. We're talking with Amy Tan about her new novel, The Bonesetter's Daughter.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire, exceeding at Allaire.com.
You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney. My guest is Amy Tan, and we're talking about her new novel, The Bonesetter's Daughter. The theme of mothers and daughters is very strong in here. Oh, before they do that, I'm going to say 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can join our conversation. The theme of mothers and daughters is very strong here. And I want you to go back to the novel and read, it's almost a theory of language that you're developing here. This is on page 262. Could you read that for us?
In this, Lu Ling's... soon-to-be husband is talking about how language developed possibly within Peking man, that the Peking man's brain was capable of forming language. And he's telling this to a group of girls in an orphan school. A girl asked, "What words? Were they Chinese?" "We don't know for certain," Kai Jing said, "because you cannot leave behind spoken words. There was no writing in those days. That happened only thousands of years ago. But if there was a language, it was an ancient one that likely existed only in that time. And we can only guess what Peking man tried to say. What does a person need to say? What man, woman, or child does he need to say it to? What do you think was the very first sound to become a word, a meaning?" "I think a person should always say her prayers to God," another girl said. "She should say thank you to those who were nice to her." That night, when Kai Jing was already asleep, I was still thinking about these questions. I imagined two people without words, unable to speak to each other. I imagined the need, the color of the sky that meant storm, the smell of fire that meant flee, the sound of a tiger about to pounce. Who would worry about such things? And then I realized what the first word must have been. Ma, the sound of a baby smacking its lips in search of her mother's breast. For a long time, that was the only word the baby needed. Ma, ma, ma. Then the mother decided that was her name, and she began to speak, too. She taught the baby to be careful. Sky, fire, tiger. A mother is always the beginning. She is how things begin.
Amazing passage. An amazing theory of language. You studied linguistics, right?
I did. I think that it's part of being a writer that you have a love first of language, and you love the power of them, how it affects perception. You wonder about things like this, you know, how did, what were the first words? What did people say to each other? You know, why were languages so arbitrary in some respects? You know, why do we have the word that means that? But ma, it seemed to me, was a natural, you know, the baby putting its lips together and that being a natural word that would come out. And
is this
the
a word
need
that,
of it.
I mean, we know ma in English, but is it also...
It is actually the use of the two lips for the word that means mother, ma, or some variation of what they call bilabial nasals, are common to many, many languages. Mm. For that word. So I think, you know, there might be a basis for that theory, but also the need for that to be the first word, the relationship between the baby and the mother, the primary caregiver, you know, calling for help, the mother responding, and then naming the dangers of the world. Not just the flowers at first, the pretty things, but, right. You know, what the baby needs to be careful of to survive in this world, you know, which is what a lot of our mothers do, at least my mother did. And, you know, when we get to a certain age, we kind of resent that it seems like all they're seeing are the possible negative things that can happen, you know. Why are they so negative?
It's in the novel when Lu Ling tells Ruth not to smoke, is what, I mean, she comes into the room and this provokes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the way it's done, but it provokes that violent language in the diary that...
It's an almost inconsequential thing that her mother is talking about smoking, but she's so angry, and she writes in her diary the terrible words that, you know, sometimes passes from child to mother, and that is, I wish you would die.
And,
you know, a terrible thing, but, you know, sometimes when you, as a child, you're trying, you feel powerless, and you think of the ultimate weapon you can use, and those words...
And in this
deadly.
Case, it almost worked.
And in this case, they almost proved to be deadly. Yeah.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking with Amy Tan about her new novel, and you can join us. Grace is on the line. Grace?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to thank you for your work. I'm the daughter of immigrant Chinese Filipino parents, and my mother and I read The Joy Luck Club and The 100 Secret Senses together.
Oh.
And we always thought these stories were for us, almost kind of about us, kind of in an eerie way. But we've always wondered that, you know, if you had an audience in mind, maybe when you were writing, maybe a mother-daughter first-generation audience or maybe some of your friends, or if you saw your writing mostly kind of as therapy for yourself or a way to kind of study your history when you were actually able to appreciate it.
Right. You know, I started writing in part because I was trying to search for something that I cared deeply about and also was trying to find meaning. I had gone to a therapist, a psychiatrist, and he fell asleep during three sessions. And I was so... I realized my ego was much more intact than I thought because the first time he did it, I thought it was some kind of new therapy mode to try and get me to confront my anger or something. But instead of going to therapy, I decided I would write not so much as therapy, but to give me something to do that I really cared about. When I wrote, I would be writing this basically purely for myself, without the idea that it ever had to be published, that I had to make money doing it. Because I discovered early on that by writing about fiction and having this sort of strange dissociated distance, that I actually would come closer to the emotional truth of what I was feeling about this situation. The situation could be fictional, but the emotional discoveries were very much about me. I right now still for myself, but the other readers I have in mind are the characters. And the characters very much based on my mother or my grandmother. And so I imagine them listening to this. And it causes for me to create a certain, to write this with a certain degree of honesty, you know, knowing these people. I try not to think of the critic, you know, or the future reader who might be wanting to hear certain things or disappointed if I don't say certain things. It's the only way I can write honestly.
Do you think at all when you're writing about these novels being translated into Chinese and being read by a Chinese audience in mainland China?
You know, I didn't think of that, and when I was first told that it was translated, it surprised me, in part because I could still hear my mother those days, you know, when she said, you know nothing about being Chinese, you know. And I thought she was right. There was a lot in my mind that had been shaped by my mother, and I, of course, had to do research about China and Chinese history that I had intentionally avoided looking at for so long. But it was ironic to me later when I had readers in China say to me, oh, this is so much like my relationship with my mother. And the way you described Taiyuan or this part of China was exactly how it was back in the 1930s.
Have you traveled there a lot?
I've been to China about 10 times. The most recent was a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. Every time I go there, it inspires stories in me. It's wonderful.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking with Amy Tan about her new novel, Bonesetter, The Bonesetter's Daughter. June, you're on the line with a connection.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. My name is Chong, and my last name is Zhou, Z-H-O-U. And I like your books very much.
Oh, thank you.
You could write such good books. It shows you love both Chinese culture and American culture, and you combine this both culture very well. So my question is, what would you advise the Chinese families in America, because they become more and more a Chinese family here, and both they have kids. So what is your advice to the Chinese family to how the, they should teach their kids to combine these cultures? Because sometimes the kids would say, oh, they are among the, all the American kids. They would feel, do they want to be Chinese? Or sometimes they say, oh, I don't want to be Chinese, and learning Chinese is so difficult, and things mm-hmm. like that. What is mm-hmm. your advice, please?
This is advice mostly for parents, and that is to be patient and know that kids go through changes in identity. It almost, you know, has nothing to do with cultural differences, and then it's sort of exacerbated by cultural differences. We keep thinking about who we are, different roles as daughter, as mother, as sister, as professionals, and same thing. Are we Americans? Are we Chinese? Are we this? Are we that? And that question of who we are changes over time. You know, part of what's wonderful about being an American is you can create your identity and revise it over and over again. And this question of who we are changes as we mature, getting into our 20s or 30s. It's different for me than now. I'm 49, and it's different certainly from what it was 10 years ago, 5 years ago. I've lost my mother. Now my identity has changed again. The other is, I think, to, you know, speak to them about the family stories, and they may not listen now, and they're certainly going to just act like they're not hearing, but they will hear. And be patient for that day when they're older, and they'll remember.
Do you get pigeonholed as an Asian American writer? Does that trouble you if people do that?
In one sense, it I'm honored that people, you know, consider me an Asian American writer and Chinese American writer. And I do certainly think of myself as Chinese American, but I worry more for future writers because there's a tendency to categorize fiction into educational components or historical components. I remember once The Kitchen God's Wife was categorized under cookbooks. You know, we want to slot our fiction, our books, and sometimes it limits how people see books. You know, that it may be, I think I'm writing about love and loss, memory, relationships, and not just or necessarily about culture. Culture is the context, the details that, you know, are part of the storytelling, but it's not the reason why I write. I don't write to educate people on culture. And I think that's true for the new writers when they feel frustrated that their writer, the work is being looked at in only a certain way. And when they hear people say, oh, we already have books on Chinese Americans, and they want to say, no, my book is not about just that. You know, it's about, you know, something else. So, yeah.
So the Bonesetter's Daughter took, I shouldn't say it took 6 years, but...
You know, and part of the reason was I was playing in this band called the Rock Bottom Remainders, you know, which I will have to say was just to raise money for literacy and First Amendment rights groups. I didn't take that too seriously.
Who else is in this group with
you? Stephen King, Dave Barry, Mitch Albom wrote Tuesdays with Maury, Ridley Pearson, Kathy Kiemann, Goldmark, you know, this is my signature song. Yes, you have to imagine me in a really ridiculous outfit, patent leather, thigh-high boots, and carrying a whip in my hand.
Thanks so much to Amy Tan for talking with us this morning about The Bonesetter's Daughter. If you're in the New England area today, Amy Tan will be doing two readings. At noon, she'll be at Borders in Downtown Crossing in Boston, and tonight she'll be at Brown University in Providence at 7 p.m. You've been listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney. Thanks very much for calling in and listening to us.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.
Yeah. Are you ready, Boots? You've been bad, so bad. You've been bad. Oh, lean over. I'm gonna beat your butt. You're so bad. Bad. Oh, yeah, bad. Bad, bad, bad. Oh, bad. Feels so good. Feels so bad.
This is double.